So it is my great pleasure to introduce to you somebody who really should not need much of an introduction, Ray Dalio, who is the founder, the chief investment officer and chairman of Bridgewater Associates, a mega hedge fund, a very big player in financial markets for a long time. Ray, welcome. Thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So it's a pleasure for me. I have to sort of put this on the table. You know, I've been a big fan of yours for a very long time. Starts back in the days at Dow Jones Newswires as a foreign exchange journalist. And we used to get the daily observations that came in through the door. And I was just stunned. I was found them just such an interesting insight. And for years, I've been wanting to have a sit down with you to discuss some of the big picture issues that we'll discuss today. And when I got involved in Bitcoin, I thought, like, I've got to get Ray Dalio thinking about these things because I figured you'd be interested in them. And sure enough, daily observations from, you know, a few months back landed on our desks, and you'd sort of waded into Bitcoin and given some very, very interesting perspectives on that. And we will get to that in a little while. But let's, for now, start off on a big picture angle here. You've been, of late, speaking a lot about this long-term debt cycle issue, this state of the world, and putting it in the sort of almost 75-year context of where we are. I'd like you to lay out the thesis, and this sort of gets back to where we are with debt globally, where we are with the role of the dollar in the global economy, the state of inflation, and the role of central banks in money. So that's the starting point for the conversation. Can you just lay out the thesis at this stage?
I don't know, 8-10 years ago, I began to see things that didn't happen in my lifetime before, but happened in the 1930 to 45 period. And then I thought, I better go back and study the rises and declines of reserve currencies. And so before the dollar, there was the British pound, and before that, there was the Dutch guilder. So I looked at these cycles, you see the cycles. And I see we're in the cycle. There's a financial component to that cycle, which has to do with the creation of debt and financial assets, and then the limitations of that. And we'll get into that in a moment. That's then there's an internal cohesiveness clash cycle that has to do about money too, which has to do with, as the wealth gaps grow and the values gaps grow and political gaps grow, you have a greater amount of conflict. And then there's a third cycle that will all relate to each other, but the third cycle is the rise of a great power to challenge an existing great power, such as the rise of China challenging the United States. And they all sort of go together because, you know, it comes down to basics. Are you strong? Are you strong economically and so on? So let me just fast forward on the financial part of that. The cycle is really debt and credit creates buying power. And so it's a short-term stimulative and it's a longer-term depressant because you have to pay it back. And so every time an economy gets weaker, and so they jab it with credit and it pumps it up, and then but it accumulates this debt, so it rises. And they keep doing that until it becomes more and more difficult. So as you get down to something like a zero interest rate, it becomes more difficult. And also the pile of that debt is also the pile of somebody's assets. They own the bonds. They own the financial assets. And all of those financial assets are claims on real stuff, real goods and services. So when we think about money or storeholds of wealth, and you say, where is your wealth? We tend to define it as those financial assets, but those financial assets have no purpose other than to sell them to get the goods and services. And when the pile becomes very big, and the incentives for not holding that are no longer there, you have a problem, okay? Because like it's gone through history. You have those financial assets want to go to get the tangible assets. In the old days, That would be go get the gold or something. But when you go there, there's too many claims to get it. And then you have that problem. And inevitably, there's the printing of money. So we can think of the financial system. We'll start there before we get to the wealth gap and the other thing. You can basically see that the cycle that we're in, the New World Order, began in 1945 at the end of World War II. And that is when the United States won the war. These cycles happen this way. There's a conflict, there's a winner, and there's new rules of the game, and there's a new reserve currency, and that's the dollar. And the dollar was connected to gold. And it wasn't really, nobody thought of it as having any value. It was like checks in a checkbook. And the gold, the money, was the gold. And so the little pieces of paper would go get you the gold. And that system then resulted in us spending. We had the privilege of the reserve currency that meant people want to lend to us. We would spend more than we earned. And those who got these dollars turned those dollars in to get their gold. And the gold stocks went down. And then in 1971, I remember it well because I was clerking on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, President Nixon says to the country, or says to the world in his very polite and diplomatic way, that you're not going to get the gold anymore. And so there was the devaluation, okay, meaning, okay, you, and the printing of money, and we had the 70s and so on. So we're in a situation that's like that. We have the decline the decline in real rates, the pushing of a lot of liquidity around, out, because there's not enough money, not enough hard money. So they have to, but everybody needs more money. So we need that more money. So money is credit. You can make it up. So the government creates a lot of credit and the central bank prints a lot of money. And there's not much incentive to hold this money. Think about cash. If you hold cash, you get no interest rate, but there's an inflation rate that's, let's say, 2% a year, and then you have taxes and things. And if you think about bonds, okay, that's there's not much incentive there, negative in some places. And so now we have a supply-demand problem, okay, because as you look at the budgets and you look ahead, we know we're going to need a lot more money, a lot more debt. And this is all the cycle. You need the more money. You have to print that. You need more money. So taxes go up, and that produces the dynamic. Now, I can keep going on about what happens in that dynamic. It may be capital controls. You start to go to things where that money wants to go someplace, and it goes to almost anything else. Particularly at all that time, I learned in 71, painfully learned in 71, that it causes like stocks to go up. It causes everything. We can deal with the mechanics of the stocks, gold, Bitcoin, real estate, everything to go up because it's really going down in dollars. And that's the part of the cycle we're in. I think I should stop there.
I want to just nail down, I think it's a critical point here, and we'll go a little bit further beyond in a moment, but inflation, right? So right now, it seems to me that the public debate around this fixates on the CPI, right? And it's as if to say, until we see that thing get up above 2%, we see this concern, then it's just a demand and supply problem. There is not enough money in the world. There is demand for money, and therefore everything's okay, right? But you're talking about this other dynamic that's going on that is very much, it seems to me, symptomatic of this problem, where those funds have to go somewhere, and they're not going necessarily into eggs and groceries, but they are going into stocks, into Bitcoin, into fixed real estate and fine art and things like that.
Yeah.
How does that work? I mean, why is one happening and not the other? And are we talking about the wrong thing if we're focusing on consumer inflation?
Well, first of all, there are two types of inflation. There's the supply-demand inflation, when demand is strong enough and it presses up against capacity, like you don't have enough labor, unemployment rates are low, and capacity is low, and then prices go up, and there's that kind of inflation. And then there's a monetary inflation, which comes from the supply of debt being too much so that they produce more of the money. And the holders of those financial assets, particularly bonds, because bonds is just a promise to receive money that the central bank can print, the holders of that then go into those other things. And then what happens is then you just have to follow the money. So you see who gets the money. And then when they get the money, you see what they do with that money. So let's say if you change who gets the money now, because we're going to change that, taxes will change that, other things will change that. That goes then to those other people. So the inflation, the big inflations, the ones that are really most important are not the ones of the supply and the demand. They are the ones like that which followed 1971, my example. Okay, there's not enough money. You put it down, you devalue. In other words, you sever the link. And then with that, then there's a monetary inflation. You go into those other things, and then you have that. So the risk, there's two risks. We will have a hell of a lot of demand because we put all that money in. Cash is all over the place. And even investments, all the investments go up because of so much cash. And how do you find a good investment? But there's so much money, and it'll change the amount that is in the hands of individuals and so on. And so now it's in cash, and that'll move on because cash is trash. I mean, I'd say that because it'll have that negative real return. So we're going to the real risk. You'll experience more inflation. Right now, a lot of it is in cash, and there'll be a lot more money being produced. But you'll experience that more in that kind of inflation. Things will go up. You could see inflation in houses, inflation in many things is going up, and then you'll start to see probably some labor inflation. If you start to see labor inflation and so on, it'll be a different kind of inflation though. It'll be because we're in a more digital society, there won't be, those things can be produced. That supply of digitalization can be produced without the capacity constraint. But the big monetary inflation is the thing. Where do I store my wealth? Okay, because what happens to the markets is then when you go to those other things, let's say you go to stocks, you go to real estate, you go to other things because they're getting out of that. As those prices rise, like a bond, their future expected returns go down. And as they come closer to the interest rate, so now you've got whatever the interest rates are, it depends on the country, but it comes down, then there's no longer the incentive to buy those things, and you could have trouble. And it becomes very difficult to tighten monetary policy because the whole thing falls apart. Everything's interest rate sensitive. And so the central bank has got to then print that. Then you have negative real returns in stocks and other assets, like we did in the 70s, but the nominal return goes up. That pattern has happened over and over. And I'm just trying to describe the mechanics of it.
Right. So maybe let's look at this from the geopolitical perspective. You talked about the importance of there being a challenger to the hegemon. And, we've got China out there. I want to just sort of frame this, though, in the moment of a little more than a year ago, when the world really went into the first sort of financial aspect of the COVID shock. And at that moment, it was clear that there was a desperate shortage of dollars. You've talked about this rise up of debt around the world, and much of that debt is dollarized. And so in particular in Europe, we had this huge demand for dollars. And the Feds did what it's done before, but in this time it did it on a much larger scale. And that is that it printed a lot of money at home, but also opened those swap rates and flooded Europe with dollars as well. And it was interesting because the illusion I felt at that time that I was hearing from a lot of folks was like, oh my God, look how strong the dollar is. The dollar has never been stronger because everybody wants it. But it struck me that there was something falling apart here, that the actual dependence on the dollar was a political problem now, that there was this, you know, we are locked into the US monetary policy cycle in a way that we never have before. And that is really anti-democratic. And so the sort of the, it seemed to me that the cracks are there right now when it can look as if it's too strong. At the same time, as you rightly point out, China is rising. And I'll get to what I think is the other piece of this, the technological part of it, the rise of Bitcoin and the rise of central bank digital currencies in a moment. But lay out for me what all this means on that global stage, the geopolitical piece of this, and then China as well.
Well, it's a great power to be able to print the world's currency, but it just happens like the British pound happened, and it happens like the Dutch guilder happened. And as you point out, if you have a debt in a currency that you don't print, you have a short position. And so that's what, you know, money and credit is not a fixed supply. It just kind of contracts. You get a debt contraction. And so if you look at what happened in April 8th and 9th, where the government, the central government and the central bank got together and did that, that happened very quick. And so you hardly notice the short squeeze. If you go to the time before that, so that took barely days, maybe week, maybe a couple of weeks. If you go to 2008, that took nearly a year, but it was the same thing. And if you go to 71, it was the devaluation. And if you go to March 5th, 1933, it was the same thing, but that took place, it was 1929, and it took until 33, and you have a depression. So if you don't do this, you have a depression. That's why the depression lasted, you know, 1920, it was 30 and through 33, the beginning of 33, you have the depression. And then, and then 2008 was much shorter. And this one was a nanosecond and much bigger. And so it creates that short squeeze. There is a supply demand for these bonds now. So it's important to understand that. So now the world, because the dollar is a world's reserve currency, the world is long a lot of dollars or dollar-denominated assets or dollar-denominated debt, let's say. There's about $23 trillion of dollar-denominated debt that they're holding, the holders of that are holding, like they can convert that and so on. And and there's a supply-demand problem, because if you have a deficit, that means you have to sell bonds. And so that means that the holdings of those bond holders have got to increase. They're overweighted in debt, in dollar denominated debt. It doesn't pay much. I mean, it's negative real returns. And you've got to buy a whole lot more of those bonds. And they don't want to buy a whole lot more of those bonds for various reasons. And then you also have China as a more effective competitor for capital. So because what's happening is it's a competitor, and it's not just a competitor, let's say military, it's a capital markets competitor, the companies it's producing and so on. In 2015, only 2% of Chinese markets were open to foreigners. Now it's over 60%. And if you look at the relative pricing and so on, it's a whole different story, because they're not doing quantitative easing. They're not doing whatever it is. They still have an attractive bond market. They have attractive capital markets that are more open. And as they're more open, and big investors, institutional investors, central banks and so on, view themselves as underweighted there. Even if you want balance, you want balance. You're getting the supply demand for these U.S. bonds coming, and you want to move that. That creates a supply demand problem that then can only be manifest in resolution by either the U.S. raising interest rates to attract that, or the dollar devaluing. Okay, so now we're dealing with that dynamic. So this is very similar when we went from, you know, the 1970s early 70s, late 60s to 1970, we had a recession. And then there was a difference between what was then the Deutschmark and the yen and how much they were printing and how much the United States was printing. And that was the problem. So you have a difference in monetary policy, supply demand, that is working on that. So when you bring up China, it's not just the geopolitical and not just the technology or, you know, it's a capital competitiveness thing. That means that when you buy a Chinese financial asset, like buying an American financial asset, you have to buy their currency. So it's supportive of to their currency, and it's also supportive to their assets. And then in addition, part of this cycle has always been that if you're trading, if you're a large percentage of world trade, China now is the highest percentage of world trade, then there's the capacity to bill in your currency or lend in your currency. China has been very reticent to do that, not to disrupt the system and so on. But you're seeing more the internationalization of the renminbi. So it has appeal for borrowers and lenders and so on. And so that dynamic is really following the same arc of monetary systems and empires pattern.
So, you know, speaking of that, somebody else that I've spent a lot of time following over the years, because I've always been interested in this big international monetary trends, is Barry Eichengreen, I think is probably the greatest historian of international monetary system. And he has pointed out that it's not always the case that you just flip the switch and you go from one, you know, single reserve currency from, say, the British pound to the dollar, but that there are these periods where it's a competition. There are multiple currencies that are actually competing, and there's no reason to say that we're going to flip and suddenly become, and it's hard, in fact, to imagine the Chinese renminbi suddenly becoming a replacement, right? So now we are entering into this world where perhaps there's competition. And this is where I think the technology part of this becomes very, very interesting, because, you know, we're moving to digital currencies. I think that is a thesis that is definitely worth considering in this context. And before we even think about Bitcoin, we've got China, right? China is producing a digital currency. It's coming out with this, in a pilot mode right now, but we all know where it's headed. And as much as it's focused on the retail market, it is impossible to imagine that it would not take this into the international realm. And now you have much more fluidity, and you also have a competition for money that's not just based on all of those aspects that you described of the strength of the economy, but of the money itself. Because this money is now programmable. This money has a quality that prior money does not have. You can turn things on and off with this money. My view is that the biggest advantage to China is not that it is, you know, an attractive currency per se, but, and there are all sorts of reasons why people are worrying about China's, you know, privacy controls and so forth, but rather that by inserting it into not only its domestic economy, but also its international relations, it will make all of that more efficient. The money itself will remove a lot of the friction for the system, and that's going to be a powerful competitor to the US. So now you have China versus the US, but you also have, you know, we saw Facebook and its partners come up with this Libra concept, now called DM, which is sort of a corporate currency. But of course, you know, the currency that, you know, we're moving to talk about now as well, decentralized currencies like Bitcoin, right, as an option for people in a fluid digital economy, as you described, in addition to gold, of course, right? So there's this view that we're entering into this competitive environment. Do you agree with that assessment, and what does it mean for how this plays out for all of us?
Well, yeah, the history of currencies, you go back just before, there were always many, many currencies. In private currencies, nobody even had a central bank. And so then the Bank of England, actually, I think it was just before that, it may have been Sweden. But anyway, the Bank of England says, we want a monopoly on currency, and we will control it. And so before then, you had all these currencies competing in different which ways. And then we come back to this world in which there is your currency and a dominant currency. But you're totally right that what happens is each country would like to close the borders and control its currency, that which is going on, because it's certainly one of the greatest powers, probably the greatest power that a government has is the power over its currency and to control where money and credit go. Okay, it would like to control those borders. But then the question is, what is the capacity to control those borders as the alternative currencies compete? And, you know, it's like, you know, Gresham's law, which is, you know, the good money drives, it goes outside, you save it, and then the bad money stays. And so there's always been a money that is the international currency and always the preferred one that you'll change. It was always gold or silver, because not only because it was tangible, but because it had an intrinsic value, it couldn't be controlled. In other words, you got it. It's like holding diamonds or something. And now you've got it. It has its intrinsic. And in periods of conflict, nobody wants another currency. Think about the Chinese owning $1 trillion worth of U.S. bonds that the United States say, I'm not going to give you any money or whatever. Maybe we'll put negative interest rates, or maybe you don't get a dime. So now you've hit it right on the spot. Okay, the countries will want to control their currency. And now we're dealing with what's under control and what's not. But you're also dealing with more international controls on these rules. So when you, in other words, they're going to agree that they don't want you to run wild with your currency. I'm dealing with, as a storehold of wealth, as different from a transaction, because I'm talking about, you know, what is it, its value is distinct from the transaction. So for efficiency, yeah, it seems like Ethereum or others, in terms of, maybe others, you know more about that than I do, in terms of transactions. And certainly for China, it has a lot of advantages, including it has the clearing system. It's its own clearing system, and there are benefits. But all these currencies are going to be competitive. And then the question is how they're allowed to compete. And one of the great things, I think, as a worry, is the government having the capacity to control almost any of them, including Bitcoin or the digital currencies. So, I mean, they know where that they are, and they know what's going on and so on. And then we have that particular issue. And so that's why I ask you, I'm interested, you know, like if you'll have cases where, you know, it'll be outlawed, and it really takes quite something say, I'm going to have it, even though it's outlawed and so on. Those have consequences. And you're seeing that like in India and other places. So the question, as we wrestle with this, are those, how will they compete? What are the pros and cons? And the thing that I would suggest is we agree on the environment and we agree on the dynamic, but why does it have to be one or the other? I mean, why can't it just be like, I don't really know how they're all going to compete, and I want a properly diversified portfolio of gold. I mean, you know, the Bitcoin people are the Bitcoin people, and the gold people are the gold people. And I think that you have to think about, okay, do you have enough of the diversification of those alternative currencies?
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't describe myself as what we in this sector call a maxi. I'm not a Bitcoin maxi. I don't think it is the one and only necessarily. What I'm most interested in is this competitive process, the Hayekian moment, right, where there's multiple currencies and may the best one win, certainly for the storeholder of wealth component of this.
But the best ones for the individuals are not the best ones for the governments.
So this brings me to a question then. This is where we start to drill down into Bitcoin, because some people will take some issues with what you said about the government's ability to control it. I think that there is a simplistic idea that Bitcoin cannot be controlled because ultimately they do control the on and the off ramps. And you're right. And so when it comes to mining, at least, you know, there is knowledge of where those miners are. However, we do see and we know that mining can spin up anywhere very quickly. It goes to where there is energy, basically. And on top of that, you know, it's hard to imagine in my mind that there's not going to be cohesion around this. You're talking about a competitive environment where governments themselves are competing. So if there is no international accord on how to control Bitcoin, it will pop up somewhere else. And so the idea that it cannot be shut down entirely is a very appealing one, especially when you look at how Bitcoin has become more and more efficient. Is that naive? How do you see, you know?
I would say, look, if you have, you know, you have private wallets, cold storage, and so on, then you got to transact and so on. And the history, like I would say, and governments cooperating against that, or even how do you deal with it? I don't know for sure. But I would say one would have to consider that history would suggest that's a significant risk if you feel that others are better judges of that risk. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's anyway, you judge that risk. I can't say. I would say it's a real, you know, it certainly has to be considered a real risk, because if you take most of Bitcoin, which is owned, and how it's owned, and so on, it's not owned in that way, and it's going to be a big thing, and I don't know. And then, you know, there are other things I don't know, you know, what is the next demand, and so on. Look, all currencies have died. All currencies have devalued or died. There's not one, you know, I mean, maybe gold can be considered, gold hasn't. But I'm saying all currencies, and I was to Palau, and I saw Palau is a little island, and I saw they had these giant like wheels of stone and so on. And I'll give you an example. And that was the currency. And when they told me the story, when they were taking one of those on a canoe from one island to another, it cracked and fell off and it sunk. And they still, the owner of that and the owners still treated that as having value. Yeah. So it's a funny thing. It's imputed value. It's not intrinsic value. Okay. Intrinsic value is another thing. You have a house, you have a car. Okay. That is intrinsic value. As you start to get to imputed value and so on, you're entering a different world. And I don't know the answers to, I'm not here to give you the answers to those questions, but so diversification would be my main perspective. So
that, like, what's our strategy for all this in a moment? But let's just drill down this just a little bit more, if it's okay, because this imputed value, I think, is a function of, as you know, it's collective belief in many respects, right? And you know, it's been interesting to watch. I've been covering Bitcoin now for 8 years, and adoption certainly has grown. And in this year, we've seen institutions like yours. I mean, I don't know whether you guys have actually bought any Bitcoin, but I certainly know that you're interested in it.
I have some Bitcoin.
So we've certainly got a number of these big institutions now buying into that. It's still obviously a small proportion relative to gold, certainly relative to dollars, certainly relative to the global marketplace. However, how important is that institutional buy-in from a political perspective? Does it impact the policy decisions going forward, whether it's for Bitcoin or for any asset for that matter? Does the financial class have an impact on the decisions that are going to be made about, you know, these rules, as you say, are going to be really important going forward on, you know, which currencies and which storeholds of wealth get impacted? We certainly know from the 2008 crisis that they do. Wall Street's too big to fail situation was the defining moment of that event. You know, do we look at this coming moment and the decisions governments make from the perspective of who owns the assets and their influence, the lobbying power over those governments? Is that important? And in the case of Bitcoin, if it grows, does it become important?
Yeah, I think Bitcoin's greatest risk is its success.
Hmm.
Because as it becomes more, right now, it's not such a big deal. And, you know, fighting it is more of a big deal. And that's it, because it's not that big a deal. As it becomes a bigger deal and more of a threat, let's say people want to sell their bonds and they want to buy Bitcoin. And they want to do that in a bigger way, like buying gold or something in a bigger way. And then there's more transaction. They lose control over that. And that's an existential risk. So yes, that's connected. The more we create savings in it, the more you might say, I'd rather have Bitcoin than the bond. Personally, I'd rather have Bitcoin than a bond. And then the more that happens, then it goes into Bitcoin and it doesn't go into credit, and then they lose control of it. So yeah, that's a risk.
Yeah, so maybe there's a tipping point, right? Where it's at the moment, it's not something they worry about, you know, because it's too small. It then gets greater demand, it gets more adoption, it becomes a threat. I suppose there's a point at which governments might get worried that it then passes to a point where they cannot control it anymore because it is so broadly held, and the influence of those asset holders is too strong. So at some
That's
point,
right. watch the total. Total value of Bitcoin right now is a little over $1 trillion. Total value of bonds is about our bonds is U.S. dollar bonds about $23 trillion, and so on. Not only watch the price, although in Bitcoin's case the demand follows the price. Watch the total values of those things, and as those, and you know, plot it on a chart and watch those things and watch the flows. Because if you start to see that kind of thing, you could almost see, you know, like the blow off, and you know, and then that kind of reversal. Right, so, now, just to put it in perspective, some other numbers, like there's a little over a trillion dollars in Bitcoin. If for gold, if you take out central bank ownerships, because central banks won't own Bitcoin as a, I don't believe, for various reasons that I can digress in, as an asset. And if you take out jewelry from gold, then you have a bit over $5 trillion. So if you were to look at it now and you were to say what's a person who wants a diversification of those two things, it's about, you know, like 80-20 right now in the world. So that's something I'd watch too. But I think those things probably are going to rise relative to the bonds, and it would transpire that way. So you want to watch those numbers and see how those go.
Another thing I think that it's worth watching, and this is something, you know, I don't know how much you've looked at it, but I would humbly suggest you do, is to look at the overwhelming amount of kind of Wild West, unhinged, relentless innovation that is happening around the crypto space. In many respects, to create as close as they can get to it, a truly decentralized model that allows them to get around a lot of these constraints. It's not necessarily looking for something illegal, but it's to build a structure that is not dependent on, you know, any of these controlling forces, be they, you know, a bank or a government, right? And so the DeFi world, the decentralized finance world, it can be looked upon as this furious effort to build this. And so I just think that's a very important
Yes, perhaps you could keep me informed of that. That sounds very important, yes.
So with that in mind, you started talking about diversification and everything else. What are your recommendations? What does a person, and I'm also interested in this, you started off talking about zero interest rates and sort of being the return on financial assets being driven down essentially close to zero. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm a little older. You and I probably, you know, it's not as big an issue for us, but I've got young daughters who are just leaving school for whom the future of zero interest rates, you know, on what they're going to be earning over the years is just highly unattractive and has all sorts of problems along the lines of what you're just talking about. You know, what does a smart portfolio look like with that in mind, but also obviously the bigger, you know, international hegemonic issues that you were talking about?
Well, I think the same thing. These things come across about once in a lifetime. or the problem with most people is if they didn't experience it, they don't understand it. I think there's it creates this environment. I would recommend to anybody who's interested, I put it on LinkedIn, my study of what's called the changing world order. And it goes back and it shows the patterns of there, because it's like if you were in the 20s, you're experiencing the 1920s and so on, and you cannot imagine what's ahead because it hadn't happened in your lifetime, the new world order. So we're in a spot of the cycle. It's not just about interest rates. It's about the whole enchilada, you know, and that could be financial, which has to do with taxes and then trying to escape taxes and then trying to control and all of that dynamic. And then it has to do with conflicts between the left and the right and the capitalists and the socialists and how they can be with each other that affects the environment. And then it has to do with the changing world order in terms of China and the United States and so on. So your children will really, you know, in order to understand what's likely to happen over the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you really need to go back and study what happened in the 1930-45 period and so on and so forth. And so I'm not going to be able to summarize that here, but I did put that description out there for those who are interested, because you've got to be prepared for all of those possibilities.
It's rather grim, unfortunately, because those years weren't the brightest ones in human history.
Well, we don't realize how unbelievably lucky we were. I was born in 49, so 4 years after the United States had 80% of the world's money, because gold was the world's money. They had control of the world central the power, because they had nuclear weapons and they were dominant. And there was this wind, and that always happens. There's the cycle, and that always happens, and then you experience it. But if you go back to 1900, just a little bit earlier, and you look at, you would see that almost all wealth, just pick a country and say, I have a store of wealth. And what is it, stocks, bonds, the currency? Okay, it's destroyed in those years with not just the currency thing, but a combination of taxes and then conflicts over wealth and power and so many things. So think about if you're, instead of an American, you're a German or a Japanese. You got wiped out totally. You happen to be lucky if you were an American, but if you're a Brit, you had some money, but it got taken away. Most of it got devalued or taken away. And so you've got to know those stories.
Yeah, if anybody's watching The Crown, it's been the ongoing story of many respects of the current monarch's life, is dealing with the fallout from all of that for a very long time, right? I spent 6 years of my life in Argentina, and I often say, look, imagine you're an Argentine, because they're this boom bust and the destruction of your wealth aspect is a visceral element of, you know, that a much shorter cycle, a 10-year cycle is what sometimes people describe this. So clearly something very real.
And so when you start to think of all the way, take your wealth and you start to think, how do I protect that from all of those things? Let's see what those inventions are. If you can find the answer really to those inventions, there'll be a hell of a lot of demand for that. You'll have the governments against you, but you know, that'll be what it's like.
Well, on that note, you know, one of the pieces that you always refer to, and every good economist and any good analysis of history will, to see where things are going, is productivity and innovation as an element of the growth story. Ultimately, the driver of long-term growth, presumably, is productivity, how we grow. And, you know, it's my view is that we don't necessarily measure it appropriately. Like, I think there's this thesis that we don't have productivity now, ultimately We may well have all of this great social ephemeral interconnectivity, but the things that we, the cars we drive or the bridges we cross or whatever, are still the sort of things that we've had from many years ago without, you know, the sort of, you know, electronic connections to them, but they're ultimately the same thing. But I think there's another way of looking at things, and that is that we are moving into a phase where innovation is less about the mechanics of things and about the dynamics of social innovation, that we've created frameworks whereby the power of collective action, the power of forming economies, is something that is now in itself this innovative process. And if you look at China, I think that the one of the things that was really interesting about that, people often look at China and they say, you know, in the past, they say, oh, China's never going to be able to beat the United States because they're an imitator, which in itself was, you know, a very sort of, I think, almost racist and simplistic way of thinking about things, but also completely missing what I think is the most dynamic aspect of China's innovation, that it is not about whether or not it is making the best cars or the best solar panels, but that it is figured out through things like digital money and these really interesting social networks how to form new economic structures, and they work in the overseas Chinese, and there is this phenomenal Chinese social commerce innovation. And I think that it's possible to look at the rest of us and see something happening similarly. Whatever you make of the crazy GameStop episode, not to say it was necessarily a good bet and ultimately the crowd lost in that case, the idea that you have these tools that allow people to collectively organize, I think is very, very interesting. And that is really at the heart of what I think is the most interesting aspect of the crypto space, that it is, these are communities who are given not only the tools to collectively build open source innovation, but they're incentivized to do so because the tokens and the assets they're creating brings them this thing. So you build this flywheel of innovation. So I'm wondering, you know, with that in mind, I mean, are we doomed to sort of this kind of failure of productivity to keep up with the massive debt overhang that you described? Because ultimately that is the best way out rather than printing money, obviously. Or is it possible that we could, you know, be just moving into a different environment of innovation that might actually be a way out in a constructive sense, rather than the doomsday scenario?
Yeah, there's a real economy and there's a financial economy, and we shouldn't confuse those things. In other words, people think, okay, the price of the stock, the price of the house, the prices go up and they think they're richer. And that's not true. It's the same house. They just do the accounting for it. And then, oh, they say I'm richer. They're not richer. They have the same house. And so I want to separate the financial that we're talking about with productivity, which is the real thing. And I agree with you that they don't know how to... you can't actually calculate it efficiently because they you're trying to measure one thing against another using a common denominator. And so let's say, for example, if you would imagine if pictures were GDP, if all GDP were pictures, and then you would say, what's the value of pictures? And you would say it plunged to zero, but yet there are more pictures. You could take them on your phone and you could take them all around. And there's not a good translation mechanism for saying, okay, actually we got all of this other stuff around, and it's so, because you have not a common denominator when you try to put that in value, if you change value. So it can't be well, productivity can't be well measured, but at the same time, we know that we're changing intellectually and so on. We are accelerating that the human, it used to be the muscles, and then it sort of goes higher and higher. And it's now, that's the prefrontal cortex. And and can you now invent and do things, because the doing of anything else, it becomes increasingly not worth anything because it could be replaced by robotics and other types of things. And that creates efficiencies and so on, but it also creates tremendous social consequences in terms of things like incomes and wealth disparities and so on that we haven't begun to approach, like how does one deal with that? So there are going to be revolutions, revolutionary changes ahead in terms of all of those issues. In other words, okay, how do you deal with the wealth? What does it mean? Do you have to be productive? What do you do with those people? Is it cost effective? And then you think about even things like how it's going to have an impact on longevity. I mean, like if you take an average lifespan and so on, you see an upward curve, and then you see the reasons for that upward curve in many, many ways, wearables and all sorts of things. So the world is going to change in an incredibly fast pace. And then related to that, that technological change, whoever wins the technology race, wins it all economically and militarily. So yes, that's what the next 5 years looks like, I think.
Intentionally, perhaps, have just set up perfectly for the next session. We have to call it there because we've got Gary Vaynerchuk coming up next, and he's going to be talking about NFTs, non-fungible tokens, which is a really interesting way of thinking about how do we, start to deal with all that creative innovation, the creative product, if you like, and putting some valuation on that. So, I mean, this was just a wonderful open to this conference, Ray. Thank you so much for doing this. I think you've laid out some framing here for all of us to spend the next 3 or 4 days thinking about where the world goes and what the role of cryptocurrencies, blockchain and decentralized technologies plays in all of this. Thank you so much again for your time. Really appreciate it. Wish we could have kept going. We'll have to have you back on some other time and dig more deeply into these things. Really appreciate
it. Thank you, Michael. It was a real treat. Thank you very much.
Thank you.